FM.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, John Biner.
Thank you. Now, we all know Walt Disney as a producer of motion pictures for children, cartoons, and nature films. Now, what would happen if he was, instead of a producer, he wanted to be an actor, a great romantic actor, and he's in a scene with Sophia Loren, and all through the picture, Sophia Loren, and all through the picture, Sophia Loren is trying to get Walt Disney to say that he loves her, but he's too shy. And he takes her to the train station, and it's very romantic, and he knows he has to get up the courage to say something to her before she steps on the train and out of his life forever. And he sees the train pulling in, and he looks at this beautiful girl, and he says, "Look, a choo-choo train."
Just kiss me once, and kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams I dreamed about you. Just how empty they all seem without you. So kiss me once, kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Kiss me twice, kiss me once again. It's been a long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You never know how many dreams I dream about you. Just how empty they all seem without you. So kiss me once. And kiss me twice, and kiss me once again. It's been a long, ba-ba-ba-ba time. Oh, yeah!
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Oh, yeah. Well, it's a difficult voice to do these days. I gotta stop with this vaporizing. That was Louis Armstrong, and before that was, of course, John Biner, who we're going to get to in just a minute. I want to thank Sean Rhodes, who did a beautiful job in putting that together. It's very important, folks. Let me say up front that I know the fundraising drive ended a couple of weeks ago, but there's a little bit of a shortfall. So if you'd like to give to my show here, if you're up this early, you're crazy, or you're nuts if you're up this early, we're going to it's malleable. Call up at 212-209-2950 or go to givetowbai.org, and you can specifically say, I want to do it in that show's name. And this is our fourth Sunday here, and Saturday. It's actually Saturday. Sunday's tomorrow. Right. Well, Sunday will be my ninth Sunday downstairs at the Commons. We have a show every Sunday night at the Commons at 7:30. It went from 7 to 7:30. We have an incredible show this week with a great horn player, Richie Vitale, Danny Vitale from SNL. We have Vanessa Hollingshead and a whole bunch of others, Barry Weintraub. It's a big list. And then, of course, on the 17th of April, write it down because it's getting awfully crowded, we have a 32-hour marathon down there to get out the vote in the New York primary for Bernie Sanders. I will be hosting that, and we have a lot of performers, and we'll be talking about that later. All right, so I played that clip up from the Ed Sullivan Show, 1964. John Beiner. John Beiner is one of my closest friends in the world, and I'm certainly one of his biggest fans and have been for a long time. He's a great actor, fabulous, one of the best impressionists ever, and a big influence on me, just like Louis Armstrong. I put those two back to back because they both had a big influence on me and how and why I got into show business, what the impetus was. I used to see Louis Armstrong at my dad's huge restaurant, nightclub called the Royal Tahitian. He worked there every 4 or 5 months. And it's a sad story that I had a picture sitting on Louis' lap with my brother and my sister that I recently found, and I went to get it touched up. It was an old Polaroid picture, and thing blew out the window, and I, looking for Louis. If I ever write a book, it's going to be called Looking for Louis. Anybody find that photo of me sitting on Satchmo's legs at the Royal Tahitian in Ontario, California, 1966, I believe. So we're going to go now to the Palm Coast of Florida, the residence of one of the finest performers that I've ever seen, and that is John Beiner. John, are you there?
I'm here, Randy, and you're so nice to say those terrific things about me.
Well, it's all true, John. I got to tell you, I was looking at that clip of you on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was, what, 19? How many times did you do the Ed Sullivan Show?
18.
18 times. Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. The residuals must be great. So... You know, it's not easy to interview because let me just say to the people out there, I know John really well. We didn't start out together, but I met you. First of all, I met you in Las Vegas in 1989 at the famous Copa Room at the Sands, right?
Yeah.
We were working in the Copa Room in a show called Comedy Kings. You were the headliner, and I did voices for the Sid and Marty Krofft show, Comedy Kings, political puppets, and then, you know, the Nicholson and Pat Robertson. I mean, we did some routines together there, if you recall. But I really had a blast working with you for, I don't know, it was like 4 or 5 months at the...
Well, that's mutual. That's mutual, Andy. And we had a good time.
You know, I'll tell you, it's 1989 because the movie Glory, we saw Glory together. Do you recall that?
No.
We saw the movie. You don't remember that. But, all right, so, well, John, listen.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw you, by the way, live was, I don't know if you remember, working with Petula Clark at the, I think, the Riviera, 1974, 75. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, that'd be accurate.
Yeah,
sure.
You did some routine with Ozzy and Harriet.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Rick. Hi, Dave. Hi, Dad. You're Dave. I'm Rick. You're Dave. You know, let's have a cookie. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right.
That was that was very fun. And you did. Now, all right, I'm not going to make you perform. I know, being that you're a mimic, the worst thing for me, being a mimic, an impressionist, and you had a big influence on me, you and David Fry, I must say, all right, you and Dave Fry, and you were you were part of that golden age of impressions, you know. You don't have great impressionists now, because
everybody sounds the same.
Yeah, I mean, going back, and plus you had people that everyone recognized. I mean, who recognizes, the big stars today, whoever they are? I have no idea what Brad Pitt sounds like, and I don't know what George Clooney sounds like.
Right.
But, you know, you had a wealth of actors and singers, and you did singing impressions. You did.
Yeah.
You did. You started out, though. I want to go back to when you started out doing impressions. You you grew up in Long Island.
Right.
What city in Long Island?
Elmhurst, Queens.
Elmhurst, Queens.
And then out to Rockville Center. I went to high school in Rockville Center.
I see. And so,
then the Navy.
And so you saw this movie, from what I think you told me, with Bing Crosby.
Oh, right. That was when I was a kid. I was taking the movie when I was a kid. That's how I started doing impersonations, getting attention from the people in my house.
How old were you?
I was 6 years old.
And you did Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
And you did.
And accentuate the positive. We got home from the movie. It was the movie that somebody looked up years ago. It was called Here Come the Waves, back right after the war, during the war.
You don't remember any of the lyrics from
Accentuate positive?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, you got to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. in between, you know.
Wow.
That kind of thing. But he did these gestures with his thumb over his shoulder and stuff like that and pointing. And we got back from the movie, and my dad was at the table having dinner, and he said to Mom, what'd you see today, Christina? And she said, let Johnny tell you. And I started doing this Bing Crosby thing. I don't know where the hell I got it from, but I just saw it, and I did it, and they, what the? And then so everybody that came to the house after that had to see me do the Bing Crosby
thing. Well, it's really fabulous, man. You know, it's fabulous, as Sammy Davis would say, man. That's dynamite. Man, I love it, man. He did
well,
it.
Well, the neat thing about it, you're talking about doing voices and stuff, and the thing is you did the heroes of your parents growing up as a kid, you know. You wanted to make them happy and you know, excite them in doing impressions of, you know. And when I started working with Bing Crosby, it was just a fantastic thing. I wish my father had been alive to see it because he was a big hero.
Did you work with Crosby?
Yeah, many times. Many times. We did Hollywood Squares. We did a big special. We did It Happened in, a big ski thing with Michael Landon and Connie Stevens and all these people. And I worked with him a lot.
Well, you know, listen, I'm looking at your resume, and I know your resume. You've been on a million television shows.
Yeah,
you've been on a lot of movies, at least a million television shows. You must get a huge AFTRA-SAG pension right now because you did everything. You know, Hollywood Squares, you had Bazaar. You had the John Biner show. You did the Ed Sullivan show, the Tonight Show, Love on the Rooftop. No, that wasn't you.
Yeah, I did a lot of them. Did? Yeah, lots of those shows.
So
yeah.
I want to go back to you're 6 years old. You're doing, who was your second impression?
Oh,
do you remember?
Gosh.
I mean, were you doing movie stars back then?
Well, that's a good question. They generally became teachers and people in the neighborhood, you know, as I got older, you know.
I see. And so at what point did you make the transition wanting to be, when you first performed on the stage, which was where, in Long Island? What was the name of the club you worked?
I got a job. I was working for a swimming pool company, and I passed a thing that said entertainment every Saturday night. It was called the Oaks Club in Syosset on Jericho Turnpike.
Wow, I bet you the oysters were great back then.
they were. Yeah.
They didn't come with any medicine. Now, when you did the Oaks, did you have an act? Or?
Yes, I did. You see, that was right after the Navy. I had a little thing I did in the Navy with a friend who I was on Guam for about 20 months, and an admiral wanted to have a party, and anybody could come up and be on the show. And make a long story short, I put this little thing together, and I did impersonations, and my friend was like the straight man. It's like Martin and Lewis kind of thing, but I did impersonations.
And who would you be doing back then?
Well, Elvis and John Wayne and Louis Armstrong and Cagney.
Cagney.
Johnny Mathis and things like that.
Well, Cagney was one of your, who were the staples in your act? It was Cagney was...
Well, back then I was doing JFK when I started in the Oaks Club. In fact, that's how I got into Manhattan. I was doing this football coach who couldn't get his guys to listen to him, and he went home and turned on the TV and he said, wow, if I could talk like that to these guys, maybe they'd listen to me, because, you know, he goes to the locker room the day of the big game, and the guys have the girlfriends and the beer and they're smoking cigars. Then he goes, members of this squad, we are gathered here in this locker room for one purpose, and that is to keep warm. It is cold out there. And to talk about last week's game. When I signed to play the Texas Longhorns, I had no idea we'd be playing real steers. Which brings me to today's game. When we lose today, and we will lose today, I want you to know I'm embarrassed when you carry off the opposing coach on your shoulders. Now get out there and lose.
Wow.
There it is.
That
there
is
it.
Great. By the way, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, WBAI.org. We are talking to, and I you probably don't like me saying legendary, but you are legendary. All right, you were talking to nightclub comedian impression Ist mimic, actor, storyteller, raconteur, because you've got a million showbiz stories, which is great, John.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can sit down and you can tell a story. A lot of people are not good at a table. You're good at it. You know who was good at it? Was Jackie Gale. Maybe Jackie Gale.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite impressions that you do, Jackie Gale.
Let me tell you something. He had to go Mickey, for the cheese.
You're right.
And the great Mickey Rooney, yes. Well,
yes,
you know, that's the thing. You know, people always, that's being an impressionist, you go places, people say, hey, Randy, would you do your Jack Nicholson or would you do your Reagan or what? Does that happen to you a lot?
Yeah, sure.
Do you mind when people ask you to do that? Or?
Well, the funny thing is, kids, you know, a little false when you played that thing.
Yeah.
And women will
say that thing up front. That thing
up
front.
Yeah, like I'd go.
The rubber voice.
When I used to fly years ago, I'd go to the airport and somebody'd say, oh, John Binder, oh, you, that little voice you do, that. They didn't know what to call it. I didn't know what to call it. That little voice you do, my son, do it for my son, that you call it. Gregory, come here, Gregory. Here's, this is Mr. Binder. Say hello. Hello, how are you, Gregory? And Gregory would say, I'm okay, how are you? He just accepted like it was the way I talked.
I saw you on The Tonight Show, where I think Johnny Carson was taken out alone or something with the rubber voice. And Rodney Dangerfield called that the rubber voice, right?
Yes, he did. Yes.
I mean, what do you call that voice?
I don't know.
I don't know what it's called. Can you do that again?
Well, I can do all kinds of impersonations like this voice.
Wow.
Do you want to hear one?
Yes.
Okay. My impersonation of John Wayne, and it goes something like this. You gotta circle the wagons, cause the Redskins are coming, and what the hell are we gonna do with them?
Okay?
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
That is the most interesting impression, and I don't even know who it was. That's not an impression of somebody. That's just a voice that you made up. I can't do it for the life of me. I've tried to do that voice.
Well, you know, yeah, some people
call
do.
Call up after and have them send me your monthly residual checks. But I just can't get that voice. And they said, all right, you're not Mr. Binder. If you're Mr. Binder, then prove it by doing the rubber voice.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's what Rodney used to call it, right? Dangerfield said, hey, John, do the rubber voice.
Rodney.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Funniest thing about Rodney to me was himself just telling story, talking about his own life in private.
Yeah.
And we're up there in Toronto making a picture called My Five Wives. He and I are in a trailer in the morning having a cup of coffee. And I say, you look a little depressed. And what the thing is, the five wives had to be Canadian ladies, you know, because you needed a certain product from Canada if you're going to do a picture up there. So the five ladies are young girls, are Canadians. And I said, getting back to the trailer, I said, you look a little depressed today. What's the matter? This is about 2 weeks into the picture. He says, none of my wives can act.
Boy, I've got a lot of Dangerfield stories of my own. That's,
yeah,
that's right up there.
I
work with a guy. I remember I have a picture with you and Rodney and Bethany Owen when we worked at the Copa. Remember he came in? He saw us at the Copa?
Yeah, he was going to do a little picture and he wanted a little film about something. He wanted me, hey, maybe you can do the little rubber voice in the picture.
Yeah, whatever the rubber voice is. I just got a nice tweet out there by my good friend Lionel.
Yeah.
Lionel, you may know. He's a big fan of yours, John. I think you did his show, right? Lionel's podcast.
I don't know.
So, but this is a lot of fun. You know, this is WBAI. It's a progressive liberal station in New York City. And last week I had a heavy show. The week before that, a heavy show. And, you know, there's two parts of me. There's the political part and there's the showbiz part. And I love this part. This part, I love talking show business the same way Sidney Greenstreet liked to talk with Humphrey Bogart and the Maltese Falcon. I like a man who likes to talk. What do you know?
Hey, why don't you lose some weight there, fatty?
Well, sir, what do you know about the Knights of the Golden Templar? They hit upon a happy thought, give them a
fresh
tribute, not an insignificant, but a glorious Golden Falcon.
Yeah.
That's a nice bogey. You know? I love that. So I'm looking at the people back then.
Yeah.
You know, and I go all, I'm all over the map. I'm right. Mr. Discursive here, off on a lot of tangents. So I'm going to go, you, Marilyn Michaels, who did, I'm talking about the people did impressions back in the 60s that I saw. Frank Gorshin, there was Rich Little a little bit later, George Kirby. David Fry, who, you know, he directly influenced me as well. He didn't have the love of performing like you have. You know, Fry was an incredible impressionist, very intense, but he did not like to perform. He would get so nervous. I remember in Las Vegas, he had Jimmy Caesar opening for him. Remember Jimmy Caesar?
Yeah, I know.
That was opening at Caesar's Palace at the height of his fame back in 69 after the whole Nixon thing that made him very famous.
Right.
In fact, I stole my Nixon from him. But he went, you know, Jimmy Caesar was supposed to do 15 minutes, did 15 minutes, and then Fry would get on the stage and ask Caesar to come out and do another 10. He'd come back on the stage, ask him to do another 5 because he just did not like performing. He was terrified. I don't know why he got into this business, you know, if he was so terrified. But he was a very talented guy, and may he rest in peace. A great
person.
He had all those people. Kirby, on the other hand, loved to perform, and he must have been the nicest guy to work with. Wasn't he like one of the nicest guys?
Yeah, he was a nice guy. He really was.
Yeah.
Well, so was Dave. You know, he just, David was just, you know, he was lost in his himself, you know. He invited me home to, when we were starting in the Village, Greenwich Village. He invited me home to his place. His father was a tailor, had a cleaning shop or something like that. And he said, come on home with me, have some lunch. And he said, one thing before he got to the door of the house, he said, one thing, don't tell my father what I'm doing.
Oh, really? Yeah, his father left him a lot of money, I know. I mean,
his father wanted him to leave the business to him, and he didn't want to do it, his father had.
I see. He didn't. So he was doing impressions back in the 60s. You were working the Village Vanguard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost a year.
A whole year at the Village Vanguard?
I did my job to feed the family, and at night I'd go into the Village and work with all the beautiful jazz musicians, and it was a wonderful experience.
Did you ever work with Irwin Corey there?
Irwin, no. I don't remember where I met Irwin, but he's a favorite of mine.
Yeah, he's still around. He's 102 years old.
God bless him.
And he's doing well. He's doing God well.
Bless
Salty
him.
As hell.
Yeah,
You know, he watches ball games and screams at his son, and he's...
Yeah, next time I come up, we'll go visit him, okay?
Well, I haven't seen him in a long time. You were in a play up here with Nathan Lane, I think, was the last time.
Yes, The Frogs,
He did The Frogs, which is an Aristophanes play.
Yeah.
Was it The Frogs?
Yeah.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, didn't you do something else with him, just the one play? Or was there,
That's it.
That's what you played. You played like the oarsman, right?
Yeah. The boatman,
The boatman, yes, right. But I've seen you since, and I saw you, I think, at we went to the Oyster Place, which has closed down. It's like all the clubs I worked in Vegas, they've all closed down. The Oyster Place that you and I hung out the last time I saw you, that place has closed, and it's moved.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, but it moved to a smaller spot, so when you come back into the city, you'll come in here. You'll perform downstairs at the Commons, I hope, and, do the rubber voice for me. No, so I want to go back. So the Village Vanguard, you know, I've never worked there. I worked at Village Gate. I started out at the bitter end in this city. Then I worked Dangerfields, which Dangerfields was the worst gig for me. You know, Rodney wouldn't even work that club because he had the worst bridge and tunnel audience, and he was so cheap. I'll tell you, 3 shows a night, 7 nights a week. I can't pay you, but I'll let you slide on the cover charge. That was all Rodney. So, but getting back to, I'm going to keep you on for a few extra minutes because this is just the first of a series of conversations we'll be having with John Binder, because I can't squeeze you in 45 minutes. I can't put it all in there. You know what I mean?
Okay,
but I'm not letting you go now, though. We got a few more minutes here.
Okay.
So you worked the Village Vanguard in the 60s. And is that your first national TV show was the Tonight Show? I mean, not the Tonight Show, but
National TV show. No, it was the Merv Griffin Talent Scout Show.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Merv Griffin's Talent Scout show was done in New York, and it was like the Arthur Godfrey show years prior when I was a kid. He had and people come on and pretend that they discovered somebody in a nightclub. It was always the producer that looked around and got those things, but they'd tell people, okay, you're gonna say you found this guy in a club. And then, Irving Mansfield was the producer, and he in the show, introduced me to the world. They discovered me, and I went out and I did this little thing that I used to do with the guys in the Navy, and that was the first show. That was the first television show.
So that was, what year was that? Do you remember?
Gosh, no.
You don't remember.
It must have been 62, 63, somewhere in there.
So, and but went, the big break is obviously Ed Sullivan, or was it Steve Allen?
Oh, the Ed Sullivan show, yeah.
Now, how did get the Ed Sullivan show? Because I'd like to get that gig. That gig.
Okay, here's the...
How do I get that gig?
Well, I'll tell you how you can get it. You just behave yourself there, Mr. Lanny Cueco.
Yeah.
And I was working the Vanguard, and I was doing my Ed Sullivan as part of what I did. And Jack Babb heard about it. That was Ed Sullivan's talent coordinator, and he popped in one night, and he said to me, "Hey, if you come over and some dress rehearsal, if the old man likes you, we'll find a date for you up the road sometime." And the old man liked me so much, he bumped time from everybody's dress rehearsal to put me on that very night.
No kidding. You went.
Yep.
You performed in front of him personally? The old
I
man.
I performed for the dress rehearsal, yes.
Oh, my goodness. And Ed, like, just, I don't do Ed Sullivan. You do him great. And there was another guy who did him really well. I forgot his name. He's
Will around. Jordan.
Will Jordan, yes.
Well, he's still around.
Yeah.
I spoke a little about a year ago.
Yeah.
And he's still doing his thing.
That's good. Yep. Yeah, I hear he hangs out at some... on 57th and 9th, he's around. I was looking.
No, here's Will. Now, God bless Will. I mean, he's the funniest guy in the world in person. When he gets on stage, he's a little bit like David Fry.
Yeah, he gets a little nervous.
He gets a little bit uptight about it. You know?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't seem to bother. You're so relaxed. That's what it bothers me that you're that relaxed. And I saw you working with Petula Clark. Clark at the Riviera, Eddie Torres's famous Riviera in Las Vegas, which really this, and we worked together there when Steve Sciarippa was working the door. It really, you know, the showbiz back then was just, to me, much more exciting. You actually had like a five-piece bands behind you, or a three-piece, like a trio behind you. Well, I got that here at the Commons down below. Tomorrow night, we have a horn player, we got a piano player. We do it every Sunday night.
That's
and
it's nice.
Just,
yeah,
I'd
it's
like
good.
To have... all these comedy clubs. You know, I had a joke back in the 80s that's still true. Every time a steel mill closes, there's 5,000 new comedians. You know, there's comics everywhere, and they don't use music. It's, you know, look at the great performers you had back in the 60s and the 70s and the people that emerged out of nightclubs. You don't see that anymore, you know.
No. Well, it's too much television.
There's just too much television. Is that what it is?
150,000 stations, and you try to find somebody to attempt a bunch of people that like the same thing, it's tough.
It's impossible. Back then, you could do, you know, even in the 80s or 70s, you could do Carol O'Connor, or Red Fox, because there was only so many stations on. Today, there's 1,000 stations. Who do you do?
Yeah.
Anthony Bourdain? I mean, you know. So, I don't know. Richard Quest? You have to do someone on, you know, politicians only. I suppose. The only ones that
get somebody that everybody knows,
Who do they get? Yeah. Flo. Maybe Flo, you know, or the lizard from the Geico ads.
When people come to me and say, my son wants to be an impressionist, do you have any advice for him?
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for a young impressionist? What would you say?
Who, me?
Yeah.
What would I say? I'd say, I don't know. I wouldn't get into it right now. You have to focus. What do you do? I mean, I don't know. It's you don't. Back then, you had great actors that everybody knew. Everybody knew Bogart, Sidney Greenstreet, Walter Brennan, Cagney, Gary Cooper. They knew them all. But now, you know, people don't know. People don't know. I don't know what. You know, I saw a movie yesterday, The Big Short. I don't know one of the actors in it. I don't remember the actors. And if you did a person's voice, I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have the kind. Orson Welles talked about it. He said these guys were so much bigger than life, so much bigger than life. We're going to to the Latin thing soon. So much bigger than life, Orson Welles said. You know, even in those TV shows, Robert Blake was interesting in Beretta. Kelly Savalas, hey, Crocker baby. You know, you just don't have it anymore. I mean, you know, the show's called Scandal. Maybe the woman in Homeland I would recognize if it did that voice. But I don't know. I wouldn't know what to tell. There's so many people singing. You do a lot of great singing impressions. I get a little more. Let me hear a little Louie. Or did you do Jolson, by the way? Did you ever do Jolson?
Oh, damn. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What did that sound? How did it go?
A little Jolson. I did the people that my father and mother loved, you know, in the when I was growing up. And that's how I did it. I just want to say, here's another one. Oh, I'll rock a by your baby with a Dixie melody.
Wow.
When you croon. Croon a tune from the heart of Dixie. Yeah.
That is really, really excellent.
But I do that in front of my brother, and he gets into his political things, you know. How can you do a guy like that, you know? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. It's politically not correct to do Jolson.
Yeah.
But I grew up listening to Al Jolson. My father was a big fan.
Yeah.
You know, my father did 10 years in prison, and when he got out, all he did was listen to Al Jolson. But he played Jolson records, these Decca records, and Louis Armstrong records.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
And Louis Armstrong and who else?
Jolson.
Rock.
Louis is probably one of the best trumpet players I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah. Louis was the best.
Fantastic.
If you find that picture, did you steal it from me?
I wish I had.
All right, listen,
like
John. I'm John Biner. Let me just hear that Jolson again, because I got a guy from the Al Jolson fan club. One of the
Oh, April showers may come your way. They bring the flowers that bloom in May, and when it's raining, have no regret. Because it isn't rain, you know, it's raining violet.
Wow.
And when you see clouds upon a hill, you ain't heard nothing yet.
Wait, whoa. You don't do Georgie Jessel, do you? Can you say goodbye to me as Georgie Jessel?
I just want to say, of all the people I've met in my life in the business, you are one of them.
All right. Hey, listen, John Biner, can we get you back here next week so we can continue this conversation?
Finally.
Huh? Can we?
Yeah, of course.
John Biner will be continuing our discussion with John Biner next week. Thank you for being part of this show. We're going to
Anytime, my friend.
All right, we'll talk to you later on today. We're going to play this cart, and then we'll go to the legendary consultant, Roger Stone. Here we go.
Ave Maria, qué rico!
Hi, friends. WBAI Latin Music Benefit Fundraiser will be held on April 1st at SOB's. 204 Varick Street in downtown Manhattan, and will be featuring the music of the Mambo Legends, formerly the Tito Puente Orchestra, with vocalist Cita Rodriguez. Also myself, Chico Alvarez, I'll be performing with Conjunto Sabor,
Los Hermanos de León, featuring Pete Pagan on vocals, and the SOB debut of Nahibe La Gitana and Orquesta Tribu.
And check this out. Added to the lineup will be Fania All-Star Roberto Roena. He'll be coming direct from Puerto Rico as a special guest with the Mambo Legends. Also special guest on vocals direct from Puerto Rico, Hector Tempo Alomar. Hector will also be appearing with the Mambo Legends.
Doors open at 6 p.m. until 11.
A $25 donation will go straight to WBAI.
Tickets available online at WBAI.org or SOB's upcoming events website.
Support Latin music shows New World Gallery and Con Sabor Latino every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 6 p.m.
on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.
Ay, mi chichi, que acabo.
Okay, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Randy Credico, and thank you, John Biner. Boy, what a great impression of Jolson and Bing Crosby. He's a great impressionist. And here's a guy that knows a lot about impressions, knows a lot about everything. That was the legendary John Biner. We're going to have a legendary political consultant on at this point that really one of the most interesting individuals that I have ever met in my life, and that is, of course, Roger Stone. Hello, Roger.
Randy Cretico.
What'd you think of that?
Boy, that binary is unbelievable. This guy's Georgie Jessel is it's a classic.
Yeah. What'd you think of his Jolson?
Much better than your Jolson. Yeah.
Well, you would know. You're a fan of Jolson. He lived...
World's greatest entertainer. Perhaps the greatest showman who ever lived. A guy whose career spans from 1917 when he breaks through to being the number one male vocalist in the country in 1950. That's a pretty good run.
Yeah, but he started out before 1917, didn't he, Jolson? I mean,
but his first Broadway hit, his big hit, is 1917.
That's the Swanee, right, or not?
Correct.
And George Gershwin, and that was
correct.
Jolson. Yeah, Jolson's story is pretty. The Jazz Singer is a pretty good movie. The first talkie, right? How many times?
It's actually almost unwatchable. It's so bad.
Is it?
Jolson's a terrible actor. The one thing he is too hammy, way over the top. But the movie is a giant commercial success, and of course it makes Jolson a very rich man because instead of compensation, he agrees to take Warner Brothers stock. Warner Brothers is on the balls of their ass. I guess you can say that on WBAI. They're broke. They implore Jolson to come make the movie. Now, ironically, the stage play, The Jazz Singer, starred Georgie Jessel.
No kidding.
They went around Jessel, signed Jolson to play the part in the movie without Jessel's knowledge, and of course it makes Jolson a superstar, although he's already pretty big. Also makes him very wealthy because the value of the Warner Brothers stock soars after, making the first talking picture.
Right. Yeah. Jolson lived in Winter Park, and there was a codicil or whatever it's called, something in the. If you wanted to move in into that neighborhood, he forbade anyone except for white people. Is that true about Jolson?
I really doubt that's true, although I must say I don't know. I am reminded of the famous story of George Jessel taking Lena Horne to the Stork Club, which was notoriously segregated, did not admit blacks. And the maitre d' looks at at his book and says, "I'm sorry, who made your reservation?" And Jessel says, "Abraham Lincoln, you son of a bitch."
That's hilarious. That's a great line. That is a great line. Did he sit actually bring her in? Did they actually sit down and they?
I guess they finally sat. She was seated after that.
Yeah, the famous Stork Club. So Jolson made the comeback in the 40s. They did the movie Larry Parks. Jolson sings again, has the renaissance. That voice then is not the same voice of Jolson from the 1920s, because I think he had emphysema, right?
Well, no, I think the real difference is in 1920s, the teens and the 20s, the recording equipment is very primitive, and therefore the greatest single quality that a singer can have is volume, the ability to put a song over and reach the people in the back rows. Jolson was very loud, and his voice was high, and he had power. By the 1930s, this style of singing is out because we have more sophisticated microphones. In comes Bing Crosby and the crooners. And pretty soon, Jolson's style of singing is viewed as very over the top, too hammy, too old time. Jolson essentially adjusts his vocal style, brings his voice down three octaves, and it's much warmer and more resonant and more pleasant. And then, of course, for the preparation of the movie, he goes back into a more modern recording studio, and he records every song he's ever done, re-records. And he dies shortly thereafter. So All of that is, of course, captured.
All those were Decca records, right?
Yeah, that's right. Correct.
I grew up listening to them. And then I went and got, because I started out, and I know my Jolson is not as good as John Byner's. I actually started out when I was 17 years old. I grew up listening to Jolson Records, singing in a little place in Montclair, California, with a piano player that was worse than Edith Bunker. I would do Jolson tunes, and the compensation was beer. That's what I got. I got beer and pizza. Inside Family Restaurant was the name of it, and I did Jolson. And I had some great Jolson albums that I used to get at Tower Records. Jolson Rambulating, Jolson Reminiscing, just sitting around playing with Harry Ruby, playing the piano, you know, and singing. So an interesting character. And
little did we know that that would be the pinnacle of your career, and it would be
yes, I know. I could never, ever, ever get to that level again. You know, there's been a big drought. Well, and then you go on. Did he ever play for Richard Nixon? That's what I'd like to know, because I know, Roger, you got a story there. We started out playing Louis Armstrong, "Kiss to Build a Dream On," and I read from the Stone Zone. This story with Louis Armstrong and Richard Nixon. Do you remember that story that you wrote?
Sure, what happened?
You knew Nixon. You worked with Nixon, right? And so I guess you got this firsthand. What is that story about Nixon and Louis Armstrong?
I actually heard the story from two different people, ironically. I heard it from a guy named Charlie McWhorter, who worked for Nixon when he was vice president. And I also heard it from a musician. The story goes like this. Louis was, as you know, a habitual user of marijuana. And Louis was doing these tours for the government, these goodwill tours, where they would send him around the globe for performances. And, of course, the United States would get great publicity out of it. And whenever Louis was coming back in the country, of course, he would, you know, he'd pick up some tie stick and he'd bring it back with him. Didn't think much of it, but on this one particular occasion, he flew into Idlewild Airport then, now Kennedy, and he had a large catch of marijuana in his bag. But unlike the previous occasions when he had just been given diplomatic immunity midway through customs, they put him online to go through customs. And Louis begins to sweat because he realizes they're going to find the stuff in his bag, and going to be an incident and probably be in the newspapers, and the entire tour will be ruined along with his reputation. It's at that juncture that Vice President Richard Nixon lands at Idlewild coming in from Washington, is walking through the terminal, sees Armstrong and says, Louis, what are you doing here? He says, oh, I just came back from Asia. We had this great tour. And Nixon said, well, why are you waiting to go through customs? And he says, well, somebody waved me into this line, one of the customs agents. Nixon picks up his bags and says, well, let the Vice President of the United States take those bags for you. Takes Louis to the curb. Louis hops in his car, and he's gone. In other words, Nixon muled drugs for Louis Armstrong.
Wow. Wow. That is unbelievable. Come on with me, Louis. And Nixon had that kind of clout. You of course, worked with Nixon, and you worked with Reagan. Who was more interesting to be around, Reagan or Nixon?
Oh, Nixon, there's no question. Nixon was had an encyclopedic knowledge of baseball, politics, just much more warmer, more engaging guy. Fun, one-on-one, much more interesting.
Yeah.
Reagan was very reserved, very disinterested in the details. Invariably, when you hung out with Reagan, you ended up talking about women.
No kidding.
Sure, because Reagan, in between his marriages to Jane Wyman and Nancy Reagan, Nancy Davis, Reagan had a reputation as a bit of a rake.
No kidding. Now, Roger.
Well, in fact, I think.
Wait a second, is that true?
Absolutely true. I mean, here's one thing that Jack Kennedy and Ronald Reagan had in common. Marilyn Monroe. They were Eskimo buddies, shall we say.
No kidding. I've never heard that before.
Actually, terrific piece about this in the UK Daily Mail not that long ago. Reagan, you know, Betty Grable, Lana Turner, he knocked out all the great talent of his day when he was briefly a bachelor.
Wow. Wow. But he was very loyal to Nancy, right? And the stories about Nancy and Sinatra are not true.
That's just nonsense. She was cultivating Sinatra. Sinatra had been a Democrat. Sinatra campaigned for Hubert Humphrey in 1968.
That's right. Tonight, what happened to him? Why did he go with Ronald Reagan?
I bet you don't get to use your Humphrey impression very often.
I don't. Who am I going to be doing this year when the election's finally over, do you think?
Do you have a decent Ted Cruz? Of course, you won't be able to use that for much longer either, I suspect.
Wait a second. Now, you think Cruz is finished now with this latest scandal?
Well, he attacked me yesterday on
NBC. Saw that.
He said that I am a rodent copulator.
I don't know what that means, and I can't believe it came out of his mouth, but, I saw the National Enquirer story that you were quoted in, and why would he go after you?
This story has, in fact, been swirling around. Every major news outlet in the country is chasing it. I've heard all these allegations from Texas pals for some years. I doubt we've heard the end of this story, but... Look, when you're the champion of the moral majority, when you're out there preaching the morality of the evangelical Christian and you're claiming to be something that you're not, I think you're especially vulnerable.
This is Jimmy Swaggart level, though.
Yeah, and I think at least most of it is true, if not all of it. But look, I've seen the women that he's accused of being with. I'd say he's the rat copulator, actually.
Well, I'm not even going to comment. Now, look, I haven't seen the pictures, but the eyes and the face are pixelated, right? As Gary Cooper would say in Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, the eyes are pixelated, right? So you don't know who they are. But the National Enquirer got photos of these women?
Yeah, I think in political circles, every one of them is known. It's only a matter before one of them comes forward and confirms. What seems to be happening today on the Internet is relatives of these women are coming forward and say, oh, yeah, she told the family that she had something going with Ted.
Wow.
The guy's, look, he's a total confection. Let's be very clear. This guy is a George W. Bush Republican. He was George W. Bush's chief issue advisor the year he ran for president and the first year of his presidency. He's a globalist. He voted for TPP, the international trade deal.
He did vote for it.
That Bernie Sanders correctly realizes these international trade deals are ruining our country,
right,
Sucking the jobs out of our country. Here's a good chance for you to use your Ross Perot, by the way, because you don't get much use for that.
I do. Not nice. You got that sucking wind. Sucking wind's going to go to China right now. If they have this, TPP, all the jobs are going to go to China. Are they going to go to Thailand? All these other places. How's that?
Not bad.
I haven't done it in 20 years. 20 years.
You better work on your Trump.
The Trump voice I'm having a difficulty with. Everyone else seems to do it. I'm going to work on it this week because I know one thing. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee for the Democratic Party, Trump wins. Trump absolutely wins it. Is she working with Trump? Does she want Trump to win?
She is incredibly talentless. But I just think, look, her husband's record as a sexual predator and the at least 28 women that he has assaulted and raped.
28 women. Is that going to be an issue?
I suspect Trump will make it an issue because Hillary is an accessory after the fact. You could say, oh, that's Bill, that's not her. No, she's the one who threatens these women. She's the one who bullies them, intimidates them out of testifying or out of going public. Sometimes she does it directly, as in the case of Juanita Broderick, the woman who was raped by Clinton during his 1978 campaign for attorney general. In other cases, she hires heavy-handed private detectives to go out and threaten these women. So the idea of Hillary as a feminist is a joke.
Right.
Just a joke.
Well, I tell you, I agree with you on that. She's not a feminist. There's a book that you wrote called The Clinton's War on Women that people can get on Amazon, I believe. It's
Amazon, or they can go to rogerstone.com, or they can pop into Barnes & Noble. The point here is the Clintons are not liberals or progressives.
What are they?
They're crony capitalists, just like the Bushes.
Right.
She's for sale. The only place she wants to feed poor black people is in a prison cafeteria.
What do you think are inside these transcripts of the speeches that Bernie Sanders keeps asking for her to release. What do you think are in these speeches? That why doesn't she just release?
I suspect they're not all that interesting. I just think she wants the whole issue to go away. $675,000 for a 20-minute speech? That looks like a bribe to me.
What about the daughter? Didn't the daughter make some money, too? She made like 60 grand?
The daughter, yeah, look, these people would steal a hot stove. They're all about the money. You could not, as Bill Clinton did, you could not sign three strikes legislation putting, I guess, literally millions of young black men in prison for the possession of small amounts of marijuana and call yourself an advocate for the black community. Bill Clinton has an abandoned black son, Danny Williams. The Washington Post in 1999 wrote a completely bogus story claiming that a DNA test absolved him. This is the same Bill Clinton who signed legislation cutting funding for single mothers.
Right.
These people, I mean, who abandons their own son?
Right.
It's astounding.
Why do people still think that she's a progressive? On foreign policy, Trump came out the other day, and Sanders did, and so did Tulsi Gabbard, that Hillary has to take some responsibility for the quagmire in Syria and in Libya and Iraq. No?
No, because she has this weird idea that you are whatever you say you are at the time, and therefore the fact that she was a cheerleader for the Iraq War, she would like to erase from her record like it never happened. Like today she says, oh, well, in retrospect, NAFTA was a mistake. We knew that at the time. She'll do another international trade deal just like TPP, but because Bernie is pasting her with NAFTA, which has cost thousands of people in the Midwest and the Northeast of this country and the Rust Belt their jobs, she's like a chameleon. She'll be whatever you need to be. But my real question, Randy, is why doesn't she stop shouting? Why is she always shouting?
I don't know. You know, if I were could do female impressions like George Kirby did Sarah Vaughan, I would be doing her voice. I want you people to know that I'm going to go against what they are trying to shove down. Or everything is a scream job with her. She's a horrible speaker, probably the worst speaker. Andrew Cuomo is pretty bad. She's worse than Cuomo, I would say. A horrible speaker. A terrible order.
He's much better.
The other day I'm watching her. Her head looks like one of those lawn sprinklers going back and forth looking at the teleprompter in this so-called off-the-cuff foreign policy speech that she delivered just a few days ago.
Her real fundamental problem as a speaker is the inability to sound sincere about anything.
She's not sincere.
She could be like reading the breakfast menu out loud, and you'd say, that's a lie. That sounds like a lie to me.
Yeah, she could be reading, I guess so. That's a pretty, I can't top that one. She's pretty bad. She's one of the worst speakers. And so how, is there a roadmap here for Sanders to, are we like finished? People who support Sanders, are we really finished here? I mean, are they going to shove Hillary Clinton down our throat? I mean, you look at the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, which she was totally involved in. And I mean, and that's why I can't understand why African-Americans support her. Because you go back to Ricky Ray Rector, who was murdered, basically, guy missing his brain. She's the one that has Bill Clinton go down there just prior to the New Hampshire primary, where he was a comeback kid. She's the one that told him to do that.
Yeah, I think there's an education process necessary. And unfortunately, it looks to me like it's going to happen in the fall because Bernie hasn't raised any of these issues.
Why doesn't he raise it? Why doesn't Bernie Sanders raise that? The fact that they overlook what goes on, what happened in Rwanda, her support of Goldwater in 64. There's a lot of things that he could bring up. Kissinger, I know you like Kissinger. Doesn't do you like? I mean, that's her foreign policy advisor. The trade deals,
I'm not a Kissinger fan, of course. I'm a hardliner.
Yeah, you're a hardliner. So let me ask a question about Hillary. Where does Bernie Sanders go from here to, I think that there's a lot of machinations going on. Like in Arizona, a lot of people think he won Arizona. I mean, could they actually manipulate?
I think that's exactly what happened. First of all, Bernie needed to understand this before he got into the race, that they were not going to be denied this nomination, and they'll cheat to win it.
Yeah.
I understand that Bernie himself realizes that that there is no path at this point and that he would like to get out, but his campaign is generating so much cash and so much cash for his handlers.
Tad Devine must be making a fortune, right? All right.
Yeah,
he must be making all those guys, consultants, are making
a fortune.
Maybe he could buy
himself a chin.
A chin. That's funny. I know what that means. All right. And he's got a weird thing with his mouth. All right, listen, we got to let you go. Thank you. That was a fascinating, quick 25 minutes with Roger Stone. To StoneZone.com, and you can get his book, The Clintons' War on Women. It's a fascinating book, and it gives you more insight into Hillary's mindset. All right, are we done?
Well,
all right, we got to go. What's that?
All right. Be well.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Luchamos para vencer.
Vendrá la guerra, amor, y en el combate no habrá tregua ni freno para el canto, sino poesía naciendo incontenible del cañón de fusiles libertarios. Vendrá la guerra, amor, y en el combate nos fundiremos en las barricadas, deteniendo las hordas criminales a punta de corazón, fuego y metralla.
Hi, Paul Fisher from WBAI Then and WBAI Now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem, don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a BAI buddy. Well, I don't know if I'm walking on solid
ground. The WBAI Community Advisory Board wants to hear from you what you think about the current state of programming at WBAI. Please tell us what you like, what you do not like, and more importantly, what do you think we need to do? Any suggestions are welcome. Please send your comments to the WBAI Community Advisory Board, WBAI Radio 388, Atlantic Avenue, 3rd floor, Brooklyn, New York. The zip code is 11217. Again, send your comments to the WBAI Community Advisory Board, 388, Atlantic Avenue, 3rd floor, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Thanks for your ideas and invaluable support.
The New York Peace Film Festival will screen 10 films April 1st through April 3rd at All Souls Unitarian Church on Lexington Avenue at 80th Street in Manhattan. Wide-ranging topics include being illegal in America, being Iranian in America, finding a peaceful path under occupation, life and death after Fukushima, reconciliation of vets and anti-war activists in Montana, a retrospective of Scottish peace activist Brian Quinn's life, and getting teenagers from both sides of three conflict zones together to draw what peace would look like. For more details and ticketing, go to NewYorkPeaceFilmFest.com. Join us Friday, April 1st at 7 p.m. for our kickoff party. See trailers from films and talk to filmmakers. That's New York Peace Film Fest, April 1st to 3rd. All Souls Unitarian Church, Lexington at 80th Street in Manhattan.
Hi, I'm Wui Jacobs, producer and host of Afrobeat Radio, a public affairs program presenting African perspectives on global issues. Join us every Saturday from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Jake Sufnarowski, former talent buyer at Wetlands Preserve. When I'm not driving my gas guzzling SUV, texting my friends in my